welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with Dr. Ann Williamson. She's a professor of neurology and neurosurgery at Yale University, and she specializes in epilepsy. And the reason we're going to talk today is because she's recently given a talk at the Unitarian Society down in New Haven on the topic of human gene patenting, which is very much in the news nowadays. Welcome, Dr. Williamson.
Thank you very much. What you had asked me to talk about was sort of the talk I gave, I entitled Morality of Modern Molecular Biology, which is perhaps a little grandiose, but given that Bill Clinton and Prime Minister Blair have just tried to get free access to gene maps, and the issue really has become a hot topic.
And nearly crashed the Western economy.
Nearly crashed the Western economy. The NASDAQ did a serious nosedive, and some of the numbers that are involved in some of the research I've done indicates why that is. There are just a couple of things I talked about, which were primarily the idea of whether or not we should patent genes, the genetic material, a little bit about the right to own your genes and where they go, what's done with that information, and then just to raise a couple of issues about the international responsibility for interesting and exotic genes. But the idea that the patent office has allowed DNA sequences, so the sequence of bases, the A, C, G, T, that makes up DNA since the 1990s. And most people I talk to are absolutely appalled that this has happened. The number of patents keeps going up, so that there's one company that filed 2,200 gene patents, and they have the sequences, but they're not necessarily sure what they code for, since each gene really codes for a protein. And there's another company that believes it's found a way to access, turn on individual genes, and it's filed preliminary patents for 10,000 genes. Now, I think that the patent office is really trying to tone that down, so you have to have an idea of what the protein does and what it is before they'll issue a patent. But nevertheless, some people suspect that all of the 100,000 genes are going to be patented within the next 5 or 10 years, which is really pretty appalling.
And the grounds, it seems, that the patent law is going on is the grounds that although you can't patent a natural phenomenon, a discovery of a natural phenomenon, you wouldn't be able to patent the discovery that there's circulation in the body or that people had brains or something. You can patent a map that you make, which is a unique coding of that information. And so it's kind of like the copyright that the legal publishers have on their particular codification of all the laws, or the copyright you might have on a map. And so the argument that they're making is that once you make a map of the human genome, you can copyright that information.
But a copyright's different from a patent in a couple of important different ways. I mean, there are arguments for and against, but the basic argument for patents really comes down to an economic one, which is that if you want to think about it from a sort of mercenary point of view, that patent laws were put in place to protect the investors so they could generate income from their research and development investments. So it's, in a sense, it's the public interest, the investors' interest, that shareholders can benefit from research done by the companies they own. And it's this protection that really is the lifeblood for the biotech industry. Without their claim is that without this ability to patent potentially valuable genes, this current crop of companies couldn't afford the very expensive research that's needed to bring potentially life-saving treatments to market. That's the big thing. And it's an important point, which is that a lot of the next generation of treatments, especially things for cancer, many of which have a genetic basis. So if you think that if we're going to try to cure colon cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, that chemotherapy is probably going to be outdated in 15 years because they're going to be able to tell, oh, you have this genetic quirk, we're going to use this treatment. And that without knowing the gene sequence for this mutation, that treatment could never be developed. So the argument to an extent is that they need to have some protection just to be able to get the first step on this. The other argument, which is a valid one, which is that we're talking, as you mentioned, a map. that once you know the sequence, it's not hard to make it in a machine. It's, again, just a string of letters. But on the other hand, the opposition side is that, you know, it is a discovery, and patents generally are not issued to discoveries. They're issued to things that are invented, and, you know, nobody I know has invented a gene sequence.
Although that research is being done as well, artificial genes and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the just depends on what kind of, you can make all sorts of interesting proteins and from genes, and the question is, are they going to be functional in a biological setting?
I'm speaking with Ann Williamson. She's professor of neurology and neurosurgery at Yale, and we're talking about human gene patenting. The topics of genetic patenting has fallen through the cracks until recently because of the breakdown in talks between Celera and the Human Genome Project. And Celera is headed up by this guy, Venter, who is a former government scientist, and he went renegade and started patenting the cell for for-profit uses. And he says he's going to beat the government to the punch and patent the whole genome, he and a couple other firms. And we were in talks with him to do what? To try to get that information into the public domain, or?
Well, the ideal situation, at least what I think is going to be the ideal situation, is to have the actual sequences either, since some companies already own and universities own patents, it's going to be very hard for the government to backtrack and say, oop, changed our mind, you can't patent anymore. But I think what needs to happen is an agreement that any research done using that genetic sequence as a basis, that there should be a minimal royalty paid, that let the money be made in a true invention. So if you use the gene, I mean, one example could be HIV research. Somebody has patented the gene for the lock in that lets HIV into white blood cells. You can figure out what the shape of that receptor is from the protein sequence, which you get from the DNA. And from that, you can start inferring what drugs will plug it up. That's where the money should be made, is that invention, not necessarily the sequence for the receptor, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I'm much more optimistic about the possibility of the public taking back the patentability of the human gene. I mean, it's so universally unpopular, and it's illegal in most of Europe, that it's trying to get an international agreement around this would be impossible.
Oh, it's going to be impossible. I guess the question is the issue of fairness, of how do you deal with the companies that are being deprived of any profits, whereas Genentech has made $2 billion off of human growth hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, I think that there's going to be a legal battle of epic proportions in terms of the fairness issue. I agree that you shouldn't do this because it is a discovery. But how to deal with it equitably? Mm-hmm. And the international point's a really good one, because if a human growth hormone, I can get onto the web, National Library of Medicine has published the entire sequence for human growth hormone. What's to take mean that somebody in Europe or Asia, which doesn't respect that patent, they can happily put it into a yeast and make human growth hormone.
What it means is that American biotech will be crippled because
right.
There they'll be the only ones respecting these patents
right.
and paying these monopoly fees to other American firms, and European firms will be able to make this stuff virtually for free.
Laughing all the way to the bank.
Exactly. Now, you've also looked at some of the other related issues in genetics. The president just signed an order respecting the confidentiality of genetic information of all federal employees and barring federal employees from being tested and classified on the basis of their genetic characteristics. Have you looked at some of these issues?
A little bit. It's one of those things which makes an enormous amount of sense. One of the things which is going to be come along first, mutations in identified genes, is going to be the ability to screen. And, I mean, again, getting to the whole profit issue, there was an interesting quote which I picked up about Canavan syndrome, which is a fatal neurological disease that occurs among a population of Ashkenazi Jews. And the people in this population are routinely and cheaply screened for the mutations causing Tay-Sachs and Niemann-Pick. And the Miami Children's Hospital got a bunch of these people together, patented the gene, and charged, it seems like a nominal fee, $12.50 for each test that they run to screen for Canavan. But the patients, these parents, were never informed that there was a potential profit to be made from testing of their fatally ill children. They came in for treatment. They didn't come in to help the hospital make money. And they are rightfully, I think, appalled.
Yeah. Well, there's been an issue of the profit-making off of human tissue samples. There's one famous tissue sample that's been reproducing for like 30 years.
Yeah, the HeLa cells.
Right. They're from a cancer tissue?
They're from cancer tissue. And actually, they have, I was reading an article a number of years ago, they have no clue where that came from. That so they think, is it Helen Lane? Is it, I mean, AG?
Lucky for them.
Very lucky for them.
Yeah.
So that certainly is an issue. There was another thing where a virus growing in human cells for a form of, I think, leukemia. Some virus whose cousins are fatal didn't affect this tribe, and like a Samoan tribe, and so there was a great to-do about stealing their material. But in terms of the screening, it's clear that there needs to be some kind of universal or sort of uniform standard that fits the federal one in terms of giving people the right to be employed not on their abilities, not on their potential risks for health. So, for instance, Huntington's disease is one that can easily be screened for. But as the genes for different kinds of cancer, breast cancer and colon cancer, for instance, come along, it could be very easy for an unscrupulous insurer or employer to say, you know, I don't want to hire this person because they're going to keel over on me at the prime of their productive years. And that should really be illegal. But it can happen currently in the marketplace. There's no legislation against it except for this white paper, executive order, which Clinton signed.
Which is only for federal employees.
And it only holds for the federal employees.
Now, you're working on epilepsy,
yep.
And this seems like an area where we clearly would face this threat, that if there was a genetic test for the three basic kinds of epilepsy that you could do, and that you would want to know that you had employees, especially if they were in critical jobs, air traffic controllers or whatever. I remember the famous scene from Andromeda Strain where the woman didn't reveal her epilepsy and the lights were flashing. She went into a seizure. She missed the diagnosis of the antidote for the alien plague, and almost all hell broke loose because of it. So is epilepsy one of these things where people are at risk of having their genetic diagnosis affect their lives?
Probably not, simply because the folks who have genetically determined forms of epilepsy tend to have much more additional devastating problems, so that they're not going to be air traffic controllers, as a rule. Not all, but some. And because often mental retardation is associated with seizures. And so it's really a whole sort of formula of which syndrome of which seizures are one part of a complex spectrum. But there we're finding more and more formally, you know, idiopathic, we have no clue, seizure forms that have a single mutation. But those tend to be fairly well controlled by drugs at this point. But it's a fascinating study, and there's a lot of work being done right now in terms of exactly which proteins can be mutated and cause seizures of varying severity.
Now, one of the very exciting parts of genetic therapy that's coming out is the possibility that we've also had the recent discoveries of neural stem cells that mm-hmm. the brain continues to produce, basically embryonic cells that develop into neurons even mm-hmm. into old age. And so we're looking at the possibility that we might be able to have a genetic therapy or some kind of chemical therapy which would stimulate brains to regenerate and replace damaged tissue. Do you think that this might be a possible modality for epilepsy?
Absolutely. It's actually kind of funny. One of the first papers that really looked at that was they found that if you gave a rat a seizure, it created the number of these progenitor cells went way up.
Huh.
So that seizing seems to be a good way of triggering these progenitor cells into reproducing.
Could that be a cause behind the efficacy of electric shock treatment?
That's an interesting question. Possibly, but I don't think so, because it takes a while for these cells to actually decide that they need to wake up, differentiate, migrate, form new connections, whereas mm-hmm. the electroshock therapy tends to work reasonably quickly.
Yeah.
But if we could find a way, ideally, of, say, harvesting these cells from an individual, for instance, you don't have any immune issue, and grow them up in culture, and put them where they need to be would be fantastic. Only certain parts of the brain really have this ability. There's a region in the medial structures called the hippocampus. The dentate gyrus has cells that apparently do continue, as well as in the olfactory system has a remarkable amount of plasticity, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Those are the only cells that actually regenerate into adulthood, form appropriate connections.
I can't give you the exact citation, but there's a recent study where there was a gene tweak on a mouse, and they found that the mouse was dramatically more intelligent and able to solve many more tests. And this kind of reawakened the speculation about the possibilities of intellectual enhancement, that people had poo-pooed the idea that any kind of genetic enhancement would have an effect on intellectual capacity across the board because of the multitudinous nature of our different mental capacities. But from your situation in neurology and being interested in genetics, what do you think now about that question? Is there a growing evidence that we'll be able to genetically enhance or continuously improve mental capacity with genetic therapy?
That it's possible, but I would hate to see it happen to humans in any organized way, just because, again, intelligence is one of those terms that's been so hard to define in the first place. And intelligence in mice generally is studied with things
pretty narrow.
It's very narrow, and a lot of it has to do with pathfinding, mazes, so a lot of spatial studies rather than, you know, being able to find your way through a city is a useful skill for us, but it's a little more complicated.
There's a study out this week from London that the spatial part of the brains of London cabbies was bigger.
Bigger and better.
It'd definitely be good for cabbies.
Absolutely. Have you ever driven in London?
Yeah.
Exactly. And so what that says, though, is that the human brain is very plastic and manipulatable in terms of, you know, if you use it or lose it. I guess London cabbies have to get their hippocampi really geared up. Again, it's a part of the brain that does a lot of the spatial memory parts. And so the question is, do people who have that kind of sense gravitate towards being cabbies, or is it because they need it? That part of the brain gets bigger. Again, it's the environment versus the intrinsic nature it's very hard to determine. You look at all of the data, the adoption data, twin studies, and pretty much everything else, is that raw smarts is the average of your parents' intelligence. So you can take identical twins, raise them in different settings. The kids are going to have the same IQ as the average of their biological parents.
Mm-hmm.
What they do with that raw intelligence may be very much environmentally determined.
Right. Well, it seems like you're situated at the crux of the two hottest parts of biology right now, your interest in genetics and your background in neurology and the brain sciences. Now, if you could just add micro-robotics and computation to your repertoire, I think you could leave academia, start your own startup, and probably be a multi-billionaire in a couple of years.
I'm not sure I want to work that hard.
A lot of folks are being drawn out of academia by the promise of riches. Has that happened to anybody in your
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When I was in graduate school, people who went into industry were considered slumming it. Oh, they couldn't get a real job.
Mm-hmm.
And that has absolutely turned on its head.
Mm-hmm.
I know a number of top-notch people who were unable to get the resources they needed or wanted at a university. The NIH wouldn't pay $150,000 for a new kind of microscope. Went into industry that had parallel interests. And they were able to get exactly what they wanted, well-trained technical staff, good salary, child care on site, pretty much anything they needed. So the resources were being made available.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now the stigma of industry is gone for people in my field, whereas when I was in grad school, it just, you know, you'd considered it as the last option. It's been a remarkable turnaround. And the other thing which has changed is the switching back and forth. It used to be it was a one-way street. Once you got into industry, that's it. You know, you've been tainted forever. And now there's much better flow of information, of people, of resources between universities and companies. That's actually something about the whole patenting thing, which is an important thing to recognize, is that many of the initial findings were done at publicly by at universities using public money, NIH money, NSF money. And so there is, I think, an intrinsic responsibility to ensure that that people get that information back that they paid for with their tax dollars.
Right. That's actually, I studied at the University of Chicago, and one of the arguments made by conservative faculty there was that the takings clause of the U.S. Constitution, which says that the government can't just come and take your property without mm-hmm. compensation, should be applied to all kinds of regulation. And I'm sure they would go ballistic at my suggestion that we just take back gene patent rights from those firms. But the answer to that is that the government investment in gene sciences and in the Human Genome mm-hmm. Project to begin with, and in the whole infrastructure of biomedical science, is the basis on which those profits and the training of those scientists and everything got going.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And if we were to amortize the value of those investments over time, we should at least be able to take back that much. we have a public right to a lot of these goods that are coming out of the biotech industries.
I certainly agree with that. And that's sort of my main feeling, is that the sequence itself is our evolutionary legacy. And it's one of the big ethical questions I see, is that, you know, we share same genes as people in the third world. And most of the benefits, the medical benefits, are not going to be for those folks. So they're, you know, again, if you want to think of it, evolutionary legacy is being stolen from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really want to thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking with Ann Williamson. She's a professor of neurology and neurosurgery at Yale University. And you can follow links from my site, the Change Surfer site, to her webpage there. And thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.